This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us for the Ed Johnson Conversations, Part 5. In 1906, Ed Johnson, a young black man, was falsely accused and wrongfully convicted of a crime he did not commit here in Chattanooga, the assault and rape of Nevada Taylor, a young white woman. Johnson's case reached the United States Supreme Court, which issued a stay of execution. But a violent mob took the law into its own hands and lynched him on the Walnut Street Bridge. From his arrest through his trial to the final moments of his life, Ed Johnson said again and again, "I am an innocent man." We are bringing you a series of conversations with members of the Ed Johnson Project about his story from more than a century ago and the memorial in this century at the south end of the bridge where his life ended. This hour, we hear from U.S. District Judge Curtis Collier and Eric Atkins of the Ed Johnson Project. Judge Collier, Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ray.
Good afternoon.
We pick up the story here. After the lynching of Ed Johnson, we follow it from that moment back to the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C.
Well, I know that the judge has intimate knowledge of many of the legal insights, but you have to understand after the lynching, the people of Chattanooga did do something, especially the black community. They stayed home. And that was a sign of protest. Over 2,000 people would go to Ed Johnson's funeral as well. And so the people did do something then. They stayed home as a form of protest for this atrocity. And so that can't be underestimated because at that time it was very dangerous climate to even do that. When you think about it, because they were the maids and they were the cooks and they were the people that were intimately, you know, engaged with the members of the white community. And so that was a powerful sign of nonviolent peaceful demonstration then that you see. From that. So that can't be underestimated.
Ray, the story concerning the Supreme Court actually starts before the lynching. In addition to issuing the stay, what the Supreme Court did was to place Johnson in the custody of a sheriff as a federal prisoner.
Joseph F. Shipp was a Hamilton County sheriff in 1906.
So he was no longer legally a state prisoner. He was now a federal prisoner with the sheriff as his custodian on orders of the United States Supreme Court. So that meant he had some responsibilities to the United States Supreme Court in safeguarding Johnson. So that provides the basis for the Supreme Court's later action. Had the Supreme Court not done that and just issued a stay, the Supreme Court would not have had the ability to take the action that it did. While we don't do that nowadays, back then there were no federal jails. The only federal jail was in the District of Columbia. If you went across the states, if a federal prisoner was in custody, that prisoner stayed in a state facility.
And then how did the justices arrive at contempt of court? Because of the stay of execution and also, as you say, in effect, classifying Ed Johnson as a federal prisoner or a prisoner under federal oversight. Tell us more about how that provided the justification for them when we talk about contempt of court for the sheriff and others here in Chattanooga.
Well, the step that the Supreme Court took in issuing the stay was completely unprecedented and was really earth-shattering. It's hard to exaggerate the importance of what they had done. One of the prevailing theories of the United States then was that separate independent nations, that is the states, had come together in a compact to form the United States. But in doing so, the states did not give up their independent and separate authority. They retained all that authority, and they did not give that at all to the federal government. Prime among this was their criminal authority. So the thinking was that the states had complete criminal authority, the federal government had no criminal authority at all, and had no right to impose federal standards or even the Constitution on the states. So the idea, these two black lawyers could get the Supreme Court to actually intervene in a state prosecution was unprecedented.
Here, Judge Collier is talking about Noah Pardon and Stiles Hutchins, the two black attorneys in Chattanooga who had appealed Ed Johnson's case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., receiving a stay of execution for Johnson until the violent mob took the law into its own hands.
It had never happened before. No one thought it could happen. But to the shock of many people, including the two black lawyers themselves, Supreme Court did so. The Supreme Court indicated that if they were faced with a situation where it looked like a state was only in form, giving people rights under the Constitution, but not in substance, that the Supreme Court might be able to step in. And they stayed just execution on that basis, so they have a chance to look at the case to determine whether he actually had a trial that lived up to the federal Constitution in reality, not just in form. But while the case was pending, the sheriff decided to move the jailers out of the jail except for one older jailer. And he knew there was a mob. In fact, the mob was outside the trial, the courtroom where the trial was going on, and there were actually mob members in the trial advocating for the killing of Ed Johnson while the trial was going on. So the Supreme Court said, we need to look at this issue because it's important. We've not done this before, but if an appropriate case comes up, we can see ourselves stepping in and saying that, in fact, the federal government does have authority to intervene and intercede in a state criminal prosecution for the first time in history. But we've not gotten to that point yet because we've not heard the briefs, we've not heard arguments, so we're going to stay it to give us a chance to do that. While the stay was in effect, and while Johnson was in the custody of the sheriff, as a federal prisoner, the sheriff withdrew people from the jail. The mob, in fact, broke in, as anyone could have predicted, took Johnson out, took him to the Market Street Bridge, and he was executed in a horrible fashion. Well, the Supreme Court is now looking at this. They've never intervened in a state prosecution before. The first time they do so, it looks like government authorities have not conspired with the mob. They've at least allowed the mob to do its will. And what will this say for the Supreme Court in other cases when they decide to intervene? If the public sees their orders can just be ignored willy-nilly, then it really doesn't make any sense for the Supreme Court to issue orders. So the Supreme Court decided they just had to do something. They cannot let this go unresponded to. And they discussed things with the President of the United States, who was Teddy Roosevelt at that time, which was a convenience. One of the top counselors to President Roosevelt was Booker T. Washington. Roosevelt had invited Booker T. Washington to the White House to have a meal, which was also unprecedented. And Roosevelt responded, and the United States Attorney General worked with the Supreme Court. The decision was made that instead of having the members of the mob and the sheriff and other law enforcement officials tried for murder or conspiracy murder, they'd be tried for contempt of court. They'd be tried in Washington, D.C., not in Chattanooga. For the first time in the history of the United States, it had not happened before, and it had not happened since, the United States Supreme Court acted as a trial court and had a trial of the sheriff and many of the people involved in the mob. It was unprecedented, but that sent a signal to other public officials across the country that you do not have the ability to just willy-nilly ignore the orders of the Supreme Court. That principle has been important throughout our history since then. When Orville Faubus decided that he was not going to allow the integration of the public schools in Little Rock, Arkansas, and the president at that time, Eisenhower, sent in the National Guard, does enforce that same principle that we just don't have the right to ignore orders of our courts, of our federal courts. That's one of the really important legal principles that comes from this case, that regardless of whether we agree or we disagree, regardless of what the public sentiment is at the time, we have to obey the orders of our federal courts. That's where our system has to work. If that is not a principle that we all agree to, we'd have chaos in our country.
In order for the Supreme Court to conduct that trial, at the direction of the Attorney General William Moody, Secret Service agents were sent to Chattanooga to gather evidence about the night of March 19th, 1906, when Ed Johnson was lynched. Attorney General Moody asked the Supreme Court's permission to require that 25 citizens of Chattanooga, including the sheriff, Joseph F. Shipp, be made to answer, as you've been describing, for contempt of court. Not only was this trial unprecedented, but the investigation in order to conduct the trial was unprecedented.
That's right. The lynching was not a rare occurrence in the South at that time. And even in some parts of the North and the Midwest, lynching took place. As Eric said, this is not the only lynching that took place on the Walnut Street Bridge. There have been other lynchings here. This is one of the rare instances, though, where a lynching took place of a person who had already gone to trial and was in custody in a jail. Most lynchings took place before there were any charges at all filed against a person. The great majority, I'd say probably in excess of 90%, took place. Some took place after charges were filed, but again, before trial took place. So this lynching was unusual in that a trial had taken place. The defendant had been ordered to be executed, and he was taken from jail and taken out and was executed. This makes it somewhat rare, but we were lucky that we had a president in office at the time who did have some concern about civil rights. And I think that came from Roosevelt's unique background. One of the most important parts of Roosevelt's history is his leading the assault on San Juan Hill in Cuba. A little known fact of history is that the unit that was next to him that also went up and overcame the Cubans was a Black unit. And he had relationships with that Black unit, and he had friends in that unit. General Pershing was leader of that unit. And I think from that, his experience in the military, his experience with other things, he had a much greater affinity for the Black community than many of his contemporaries did. As I mentioned earlier, he actually invited Booker T. Washington to have dinner with him at the White House, which created an awful lot of criticism because it was signaling that a Black man could be on the same social level, and not only as a white person, but the president of the United States. And that disturbed an awful lot of people in the South, and also some people in the North. The reaction of the president was good. He wanted the matter investigated. He wanted it prosecuted by the federal government, and that happened. The Supreme Court set as a trial court and actually heard the evidence, examined the evidence, and rendered a decision. Again, it's almost unimaginable that the Supreme Court would do that. The Supreme Court hears appeals. They take a case that's already been tried. There's a record. There have been decisions made. They review all of that, and then they decide whether the decision from the local was correct or not. That's not what happened in this case.
And Eric, we have to remember, amid the investigation, amid the legal trail, as the judge was just referring to here, there is always front and center the social aspect to this, the times in which all of this unfolded.
Yes, you have to, and really you have to backtrack too, because in Supreme Court history, you know, you had a case U.S. versus Harris. And so if you know anything about U.S. versus Harris, that is when a lynch mob in 1883 broke into a jail in Crockett County, Tennessee, and took out four Black detainees and killed one. And that case made it all the way to the Supreme Court, and it was just one of an infamous decision. And during that whole decade from the mid-1870s to 1880s, a lot of the Supreme Court decisions really favored, you know, some of the local control. But we know when you had local control, what would happen? And that went starting from Cruikshank. Cruikshank was a horrible, horrible decision as well. And so maybe this case was a bit of a corrective measure in a de facto sense for the Supreme Court, because you did get some rulings that did sanction some of this stuff, you know, as a result of the ruling. But the social dynamic can't be underestimated. Many civil rights figures did get involved in this case. W.E.B. Du Bois was one. He thought that Hutchins and Hardin should just drop the case because he wasn't sure if this case should be a litmus test of ending the practice of racial terror. So it can't be underestimated. The eyes of the nation were indeed on this case. They were indeed.
And when a reporter tracked down Sheriff Joseph F. Shipp for a comment as the investigation was underway, the sheriff said, quote, "The Supreme Court of the United States was responsible for this lynching. I had given that Negro every protection that I could. For 14 days, I had guarded and protected him myself. In my opinion, That act of the Supreme Court of the United States and not allowing the case to remain in our courts was the most unfortunate thing in the history of Tennessee. The people of Hamilton County were willing to let the law take its course until it became known that the case would probably not be disposed of for 4 or 5 years by the Supreme Court of the United States. The people would not submit to this, and I do not wonder at it, unquote.
I think what Sheriff Shipp was doing was going back to that theory that I had posited earlier, that the federal government was a government of very limited authority, and it had no ability, no legitimate authority to intervene in certain state matters, foremost among them, the criminal prosecutions. It showed a real contempt, though, for the United States Supreme Court. Even if the court is wrong about something, the answer is not just to ignore the court. The answer is to try to convince the court to change its decision or to go to a higher court. Again, we'd have chaos if everybody had within their power to just say that because we don't agree with what the Supreme Court did, we're going to know the Supreme Court allows someone to be murdered. That's not how a civilized society can function. It also shows a fundamental lack of understanding how other people perceive what happened. This fair trial that the sheriff was talking about, Johnson gave up his right to appeal in the state system.
Here, Judge Collier is talking about Johnson's first team of lawyers, all of them white, at his criminal trial in Chattanooga before Pardon and Hutchins took his case.
And he gave that right up because his lawyers told him that you have to announce your decision before the judge who tried you. And you're supposed to do it either immediately after the decision or soon afterwards. If you tell the judge now that you want to appeal your case, then this mob that you hear on the outside of the jail and the members here in the courtroom, you're going to get lynched here and now. So your options are to be lynched here and now or to be executed. It is your choice. That's the fair trial and the protection that Sheriff Shipp was talking about. In modern times, that would be just unimaginable that we would tolerate anything at all like that.
And I always find it fascinating, too, a lot of the stories that were in the press, because a lot of the press accounts were very, very colorful at the time. You had one paper that was really on the side of the public and the lynch mob and sort of incensing them to a frenzy. And you had the other paper that was more a little more cautious, a little more wanting you to adhere to the rule of law. And so it was an interesting tit for tat, those newspaper accounts that you get at the time as well, Ray.
And Eric, I think that was one of the main reasons for the mob action, the incitement on the part of the media. And it was not just one paper, there were several papers, and not just in Chattanooga, there were papers in Atlanta, papers in other parts of the country also, that also incited mob violence. There was extremely irresponsible action on the part of the media. That's also less for us today. We see that some aspects of the media also engaged in irresponsible actions that inspire people to engage in uncivil activities. That's dangerous for us as a society. The other really big legal point that came out of this is that the Supreme Court laid the foundation for a lot of the legal actions that we take for granted now. It laid the foundation for our modern habeas theory, prisoner litigation, death penalty litigation. Even a lot of the civil rights and civil protest litigation that you see now, you really can trace that back to the Ed Johnson case. By the Supreme Court saying that there might be some federal constitutional rights that states have to obey, that's something we take for granted now. But for most of our history, from the time that the Constitution was adopted until the early part of the last century, that was not the understanding at all. And it came about because of this young black man in Chattanooga, Tennessee, who went through an unfair trial, who was lynched and killed shortly afterwards, had justices on the Supreme Court looking at this and saying that this is not how we do things in the United States of America. So all the people who have complaints about police mistreatment, about unconstitutional searches and seizure, about excessive force, about wrongful killings, they really have this instance and this case to thank for it.
the United States Supreme Court holds this trial in October of 1906 of Sheriff Shipp and 24 other citizens of Chattanooga in the old Senate chamber at the U.S. Capitol. All 25 defendants enter not guilty pleas. Their defense lawyers question the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court in granting the stay of execution for Ed Johnson, whether the telegram sent by Associate Justice John Marshall Harlan was the proper way to give notice. Sheriff Shipp's lawyer also questioned the Supreme Court's jurisdiction to hear the case and hold this trial for contempt of court.
That's exactly correct. Shipp's our chief lawyer argued that since the Supreme Court, that is the federal government, had no right to intervene in a state prosecution, then that means the Supreme Court's stay order was illegitimate, was illegal. Therefore, if that order was illegal, then Johnson could never have been put in the custody of the sheriff legitimately, and there could be no contempt of court. And again, that goes back to the theory that the United States Supreme Court is really a separate nation from the state of Tennessee. It would be like Canada deciding that it had some right to intervene in a Tennessee prosecution. They did not understand or did not agree that the United States is not composed of states, it's composed of people. It was not the states that created the United States, it was the people that created the United States. Those are the first words of the preamble to the Constitution. It does not say, we the states. It says, we the people. And for most people, that was settled at the Civil War. That was one of the things the Civil War was based upon. But there was still a lot of thinking that went on. And some of that thinking even resided in the Supreme Court. As Eric said, after the Civil War, there were several cases that went to the Supreme Court that were very, very hostile to Reconstruction, to some of the basic theories of what the United States is as a nation. And this decision that the Supreme Court rendered was a radical departure from some of that prior philosophy that we saw in Supreme Court cases. Another thing that comes up, I talked to youngsters and law clerks about the decision, what the sentence was, and they're shocked that the sentences were so lenient. Sheriff Shipp got the most lengthy sentence. He received a sentence of 6 months. Most people, when they hear the facts, they think that something like, 10 or 20 years would be most appropriate. Well, because it's contempt of court, that was the charge, that's a misdemeanor. And if a misdemeanor has a punishment of 6 months or less, there's no right to a jury trial. If the sentence had been a year or longer, they're going to right to a jury trial. And if there had been a jury trial, guess where the jury would be drawn from? It would be drawn from Chattanooga, Tennessee, Hamilton County. We don't know how many people were in the mob, but there are estimates there were hundreds of people in the mob. And as we talked about with the newspapers and the local sentiment, you could be willing to bet that many people on whatever jury would have been selected would have been supporters of the mob and supporters of what would have happened.
And an all-white jury.
And would have been an all-white jury. And that would have meant that the sheriff and the other defendants would have been found not guilty. Well, again, what message would that send? If the Supreme Court decides that we cannot allow people to ignore our decision, we've got to do something, and then we have a jury drawn up from there where the lynching took place and the defendants are acquitted, that sends the exact opposite message what the Supreme Court wanted sent. So they wanted to make sure they had control of the trial, they want to have control of the decision, and want to have control of the sentence. But that meant they can only render a sentence of 6 months or less.
They were leaving nothing to chance.
Oh, no, they were leaving nothing to chance. To me, this is one of the most important decisions since I believe it was Marbury Madison that even gave you the right over judicial review. It was that important for the Supreme Court as a branch of government to assert its authority. That can't be underestimated, because if you don't respect the rule of law and the decisions of the Supreme Court, you descend into anarchy. And so the Supreme Court, even more for Ed Johnson, justice for him, had to do it for the sake of our democracy, because you have to respect the Supreme Court. You have to respect the laws. If you don't respect the courts and the laws, then, like I said, you have the inmates run the asylum. And so from that perspective, it's very important.
I agree with Eric. 100% he's exactly right. If as a society, we're not going to accept the decisions of courts, we're not going to follow the law, And what that means is that the strong and the violent and the wealthy and the powerful rule. And that means everybody else is subject to whatever strong person comes around and orders you to do something. And ultimately what that would do would be that people would start forming groups. So you look for the most powerful person you can to protect you. Your friend will look for the most powerful person he or she can to protect them. And then you have all these warring factions out there controlled by strong people. That is not a society that is a very healthy society. That actually exists in some parts of the world. It has existed from time immemorial. But that is not what we want as a society.
And you have to remember, too, a lot of people still agree with the sheriff. When he came home, 10,000 people greeted him at the train station to a hero's welcome. And so it was a lot of sentiment even after that case in support of the sheriff.
When the trial was conducted, John Stonecipher, a prosecution witness, testified as to how the lynchers attempted to recruit him to join the mob, promising that the sheriff, Joseph F. Shipp, would not interfere. Stonecipher had moved to Georgia after being told his house would be blown up if he didn't leave town. Ellen Parker, a moonshiner held at the county jail at the time of the lynching of Ed Johnson, recounted how a deputy warned her about the lynching and told her to stay in her cell.
Well, it was premeditated, that's what you asked. There's no doubt about that. A lot of times these things are premeditated, but this one was a little more premeditated than most, because a lot of times you did have a lynch mob form, you know, just spur of the moment. But it was an orchestrated plan from all the evidence and readings that you can go and review.
Shipp was on notice that Johnson's life was in danger. Even before the trial, he had moved Johnson out of Chattanooga twice. He moved him to Nashville on one occasion because of danger of the lynch mob. He moved him to Knoxville on another occasion because of lynch mob. While the trial was going on, there was a lynch mob on the streets outside of the courthouse, yelling and screaming and making threats. Members of the lynch mob came into the courtroom and made threats while the trial was going on. He was warned by members of the community that Johnson's life was in danger and he should be moved while the appeal was taking place. Instead of doing that, Shipp decides to move all the jailers out of jail except one elderly jailer. He takes all of the prisoners off of the floor where Johnson is. So there are only two prisoners, a female and Johnson. There are only prisoners on that floor. Then he decides he's going to stay away from the jail that night. The Supreme Court found all that compelling that Shipp actually approved of the lynching. He did everything in his power except for swinging the jailhouse doors wide open.
And we know how they felt about the Supreme Court too, Ray, because after they would hang Ed Johnson on the bridge, we know the note that he left John Marshall Harlan telling him to come get Ed Johnson then. And so we know what the message was during that event.
And yet, during the Supreme Court's trial of the sheriff and the two dozen other Chattanoogans, when it came time for Sheriff Shipp to testify, he maintained how he had rushed to the jail when he had heard about the lynching, only to be imprisoned by the mob. He said he didn't recognize any of the men involved. He also said he did not use physical force or draw his gun against the men.
Well, it took him over 3 hours to break into the jail, though, Ray. It ain't like they had the key and actually opened the door. 3 hour time, when you know it's taking all that time for the mob to break into the door. And that ain't sense them as well, that they couldn't get in there quickly either. What does that say? I mean, that tells you about everything you need to know.
Ray, if someone's really interested in stopping the mob, you wonder, why do they go there by themselves? Why don't they call their other deputies and their other jailers and perhaps even empower a posse? If you're going by yourself, you don't even withdraw your gun. The only thing you have is moral persuasion. And obviously, when you're facing a mob where people are not acting rationally, moral persuasion is not going to go all that far at all. So as the Supreme Court did, the sheriff's explanation really leaves a lot to be desired in terms of credibility.
We are speaking with Judge Curtis Collier and Eric Atkins about the U.S. Supreme Court conducting its own trial of Hamilton County Sheriff Joseph F. Shipp and others after the lynching of Ed Johnson on Chattanooga's Walnut Street Bridge in 1906.
And it took 2 years for the Supreme Court to sift through the thousands of pages of testimony generated by the trial that it conducted. And then we arrive at May 24th, 1909. The court issued its assessment of this. And then from the initial group of 25, the court had narrowed its focus to six men, including Sheriff Shipp. And then we get to November of 1909, November 15th, and then there were the sentences. The prisoners were delivered to the DC jail. But as you were saying earlier, how much time did they serve? What were their conditions of their sentence? And then the heroes welcome, the quote unquote heroes welcome that they received upon their return to Chattanooga.
In terms of retribution, the sentences were very, very low, and we may even consider them inadequate. Shipp received the longest sentence. He received 6 months. There were six people found guilty. Shipp, his jailer, Jeremiah Gibson, and four members of the mob. The other mob members who were tried were found not guilty. And although the sheriff did receive a hero's welcome, it is telling that since that decision by Supreme Court, no other state official violated openly an order of the United States Supreme Court. So we may consider 6 months to be a very lenient sentence. I don't think most public officials would really relish the idea of spending 6 months of their life in jail. So it had the desired effect.
For example, fast forward from 1906 to 1963, when Alabama Governor George Wallace stood in the schoolhouse door of the Foster Auditorium in Tuscaloosa in a symbolic move to block the integration of black students at the University of Alabama, despite the order of a U.S. district judge to forbid him from interfering.
Even when George Wallace was standing in the doorhouse, we're talking back in the 60s now, he did not disobey an order of a court. He pretended he was going to, and he made public gestures, but he never, ever violated a court order. The same thing with Governor Bass in Mississippi. They made noises, they made gestures, they did things, but they never violated an order of a court.
Another important aspect that you have to recognize, because you had over 4,700 lynchings in the United States from the late 1800s to 1950. As many as I've looked at, and this is what I've told people, I haven't found hardly one besides the case of Ed Johnson that some sort of measure of atonement was actually done about. And so that's the question you ask, what was done to rectify any other lynchings? And so Ed Johnson is one of the few cases, if not the one, well, something was actually done about the lynching. And so, yes, you would want a longer sentence proportional to the law, but something was actually done. That's what the lesson that I try to tell people when they ask me that question, because they do ask, oh, that's a short sentence. Oh, they didn't get hardly anything done. Something was done about a lynching, and that can't be underestimated.
This stands out as the only time when the Supreme Court of the United States has conducted a criminal trial. And as important as it was in setting precedent, in other ways, it's seen as an anomaly not known by as many people, even in legal circles, as it should be.
I think that's exactly right. It's really a tragedy that the case is not as widely recognized. One is because it was the first time the Supreme Court has acted as a trial court. But the second reason is because it lays the foundation for a lot of our modern jurisdictions, so many different areas. The Supreme Court said in that case that it may be possible that we are presented with a case where a person was given all of the form of a fair trial, but not its substance, that we will decide if that offends the Constitution and that that prosecution was unconstitutional. Because Johnson was lynched, they never got a chance to answer the question. Next time they were presented with the issue was about 10 years later in the Leo Frank case. The case came out of Georgia involving a Jewish young man. He was accused of raping and killing a white woman. And his case went to Supreme Court. Supreme Court again said that if we're presented with a case that looks like a trial was fair in form, but not in substance, we might overturn it. We don't think the facts of this case need it. After that decision, people from the place where the rape and murder took place, Marietta, Georgia, which is part of Atlanta now, went to the state prison in Milledgeville, Georgia. They broke into the prison, not a jail, not a local jail or county jail, but the state prison, took Frank out of the state prison and carried him all the way back, drove him all the way back to Milledgeville, and they hung him there in Milledgeville. You can go on the internet now and see pictures of his hanging body with the smiling crowds looking up at his body. About 10 years after that, in a case out of Arkansas, the Elaine, Arkansas race riot, Supreme Court finally decided this is the case. There is a federal right to a fair trial that we will impose on the states. And in this case, that has been violated. And Supreme Court set aside the conviction of a number of black sharecroppers from eastern Arkansas who had been sentenced to death in 30-minute trials en masse. And that led to, as I said earlier, a lot of our modern understandings of what rights we have as citizens of the United States, the right to a lawyer at a trial, the right to an appointed lawyer if we cannot afford one, the right to not be coerced, to be tortured, to get us to confess, Miranda warnings. All these things came out of the Ed Johnson decision. The change from viewing the states as completely independent nations, but rather as part of a new nation where there are certain rights that flow from the federal government to everybody, means that if you think that a police officer has mistreated you, that's a violation of federal rights. And you don't have to depend upon the states for that protection. If you decide to march and protest in the streets and you're being prohibited from protesting, that's a federal right that you can go to court to have protected. There are just so many rights that we take for granted now that we can trace directly back to the Ed Johnson decision. And it's a shame that the case does not get more recognition from that.
And it was a long road to get there. When we talk about the remaining prisoners leaving the D.C. jail and coming back to Chattanooga, including Sheriff Joseph F. Shipp, receiving a welcome of 10,000 people, receiving a welcome home of 10,000 people in Chattanooga to the sounds of, I wish I was in Dixie.
Well, another lesson that comes out of this that I think is very important that people understand is that when people stand up for the rights and people do the right things, sometimes not only will you not be recognized and applauded for that, but sometimes you'll be punished for it. So we have Shipp and other defendants being celebrated and held up. Shipp ran for election again, he won. Just as we know, was murdered in a very horrible fashion. The two black lawyers in the case, S.L. Hutchins and Pardon, were run out of town. Hutchins was one of the premier black lawyers in the entire South at that time. He was older of the two lawyers and had an extremely established practice. I understand it was a very profitable practice also. And as a result of his involvement in this case, he lost his practice, his house was burnt down, and he had to leave the state of Tennessee. My research indicates that he lived out his life as a barber. So this very accomplished, very intelligent lawyer who participated in one of the greatest cases lives out his life as a barber after that. Pardon, the younger one, also had to leave town. I had to leave the state because of it. I'm not sure where he wound up. I've heard that he went to Oklahoma. I've heard he went to other places, but my research has not told me definitively where he went. Sometimes in standing up for what's right, there's a sacrifice involved. And as people, we have to understand that doing the right thing, as simple as right, does not mean you're going to get pat on the back, does not mean you're going to get rewarded. Sometimes it may be that you actually make a sacrifice. And that's been true throughout our history also. A lot of the people that gave up their lives during the revolution I did so for something bigger than themselves. People that fought on the North side in the Civil War, the same thing. So that's another important lesson that we can draw from this. Pardon and Hutchins are extremely inspirational figures, and we can learn an awful lot from them, but it's also tragic that they bore a huge sacrifice for their efforts.
Well, and I know a lot of my research on Pardon says that he went to the state of Illinois and had a distinguished career as an attorney. And in fact, the General Assembly of Illinois did write a resolution for him. And so that can go back and be reviewed. He argued over 200 cases in Illinois. And so, but it was tragic, you know, how they were run out of town. And that's why we said, Ray, that this case was always known by the Black community, but wasn't spoken about, because it was a lot of racial undertones. And it just wasn't something that the community wanted to talk outwardly about because of some of the atrocities that went on there. That's a fact that you have to remember as well.
And that, too, was part of the pattern in lynching after lynching after lynching, not only across the South, but in other parts of the country.
Yes, I think it was. And it wasn't our finest hour. It wasn't our finest hour. But one thing that the judge said that you have to remember, too, that is correct. When you have these cases, I don't think a lot of people understand what the word president really means. And if you're looking at an education sense, education, you will call it scaffolding. And that's simply building on top of something. And so when you have a legal president, that is the standard and the guideline and the statute, and you build upon that. And that's why this case is so important, not for where it started, but from, as the judge was saying, when you talk about due process, when you talk about equal protection, when you talk about the Miranda rights, this case was one of the starting places where now we can build upon this from a foundational sense, according to the law. That's really, you know, one of its significant components.
And Ray, another lesson we can draw from this is how important it is for us to adhere to legal process. We cannot shortcut legal process or ignore it just because we saw it on television, or we don't need a grand jury, or we don't need presumption of innocence. We have an awful lot of sentiment in various types of cases now where people are objecting to the process, and they don't understand why we just don't go directly to conviction without an investigation, without a trial, without giving the other side a chance to put on their defense. And this is a good example of what happens when we give in to that. When we give in to it, the mob arises and the mob will take action. When the mob takes action, even if the person is guilty of something, that's really not the way that as a society we ought to want to do things. The mobs act because of passion, momentary passion. And oftentimes if passion is correct, it's also likely to be wrong. But someone's going to suffer as a result of that passion. I think it's always wise to keep in mind that the central part of the story has to be Ed Johnson. The life he lived, although it was short, the way he was treated, and his tragic end. A lot of things came out of it. Some good things came out of it. But we cannot forget that he has to be the central part of the story, Ed Johnson. And I salute him.
Judge Collier, Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you, Rick.
In our next and final conversation, we hear again from Eric Atkins, this time with Marianne Martin and Steve Durthick, also with the Ed Johnson Project, about the memorial at the south end of Chattanooga's Walnut Street Bridge.
All of us have come at this in different ways and from different perspectives and become a part of this effort from our own points of view, but all have this passion about the fact that this story has been overlooked and discounted and not told for so long. You know, this story that has national importance and is taught in law schools because of its legal precedent, but Chattanooga has not acknowledged it. And as Steve mentioned, yeah, you know, when I moved to Chattanooga in 2011, I was handed a copy of the book by Leroy Phillips and Mark Cureton. I read the book. I thought it was a fascinating story. I immediately emailed Mark Cureton and wanted to know if Chattanooga had any memorials or markers for Ed Johnson, or if there was any further work after his book and then found out that there wasn't. And it kind of sat on my back burner for the rest of the time. I had sort of internally pledged that I would see a memorial or a marker created before I left Chattanooga. And then that sort of developed into when I was teaching, as I began to use this story and just saw the passion of my students. I mean, a credit to so many of my students who were young and they were, you know, struggling to go to school, and most of them were working, but just their passion and also their anger that they had been deprived of this part of their history. Many of them were African-American students. And I still just remember one of them talking about, you know, if I had heard this story, if I had known about the role models, it's not part of Chattanooga history. And so just seeing their passion and knowing how much this would have meant to them to be able to know this story is really what drove me. And I am grateful to see the change in the conversations, even just in the 5 short years that we've been doing this, where there is a greater understanding of why this history matters and how important it is to remember this just as a way of healing and reconciliation for our communities, that it must be talked about.
Our thanks to Judge Curtis Collier, Eric Atkins, the members of the Ed Johnson Project, and to Tony R. Smith Sr., Willie Kitchens, and their fellow musicians for I Am an Innocent Man, the Ed Johnson song. Visit the Ed Johnson Project at its website, edjohnsonproject.com, and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.